Reading is taken from John's Gospel, chapter 11, starting at verse 45 and going all the way to chapter 12, verse 19. I'm reading from the New International Version. If that's slightly different from the version in front of you, don't worry, because it's not sort of the precise words used, which I'm going to be preaching on, but the overall picture. So starting off, John chapter 11, verse 45. I like the fact that my Bible has got sort of got paragraph headings, and this one is entitled, The Plot to Kill Jesus. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did, put their faith in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing? They asked. Here is this man performing many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish. He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the Jews. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the desert, to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, many went up from the country to Jerusalem for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover. They kept looking for Jesus, and as they stood in the temple area, they asked one another, "What do you think? Isn't he coming to the feast at all?" But the chief priests and Pharisees had given orders that if anyone found out where Jesus was, he should report it so that they might arrest him. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus arrived at Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honour. Martha served, while Lazarus was amongst those reclining at the table with him. Then Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the whole house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Leave her alone, Jesus replied. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came, not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and putting their faith in him. The next day, the great crowd that had come for the feast heard that Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. They took palm branches and went out to meet him, shouting, "Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the King of Israel." Jesus found a young donkey and sat on it, as it is written, "Do not be afraid, O daughter of Zion. See, your king is coming, seated on a donkey's colt." At first, his disciples did not understand all this. Only after Jesus was glorified did they realize that these things had been written about him and that they had done these things to him. Now the crowd that was with him when he called Lazarus from the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to spread the word. Many people, because they had heard that he had given this miraculous sign, went out to meet him. So the Pharisees said to one another, "See, this is getting us nowhere. Look how the whole world has gone after him." It's always difficult starting a reading with the word "therefore," because obviously it ties in with what's just been written. And so I trust you'll forgive me if I go back over what was last week's talk, just briefly. The death and raising from the dead of Lazarus by Jesus. Jesus was a close friend of the family of Lazarus, who had two sisters, Martha and Mary. And Jesus was told that Lazarus was sick, and Jesus then told the disciples that Lazarus had actually died. And I love the fact that it's Thomas, when Jesus talks about going to Bethany, which is only 2 miles from Jerusalem, that it's Thomas, the one that is so often maligned and called Doubting Thomas, who says, "Come, let's go and die with him." Jesus was fully aware of the plot to kill him. And it wasn't Peter who you'd expect to say, "Come on, let's go." It wasn't the bold, brash Peter. It was the one that we refer to as Doubting Thomas. Well, I prefer to call him Skeptical or Wanting Proof Thomas. Jesus and the disciples go to the family. They are mourning. They've been mourning for 4 days. Lazarus is in the tomb. And a great many Jews from Jerusalem have come out to support the family. Lazarus, Mary and Martha were very popular. And Jesus goes to the tomb, commands that the stone be rolled away, and shouts, "Lazarus, come out." He has to say "Lazarus," otherwise everyone in there would have come out. But before the stone is rolled away, it's Mary, I think it is, who says, "But there'll be a terrible odour." A reminder that the body of Lazarus wasn't just dead, it was rotting. It was decaying. This is significant because raising someone from the dead, I could say, wasn't a new thing. I might not have got all of them, but I found 4 examples in the Bible up until this point. Elijah, raised from the dead, the son of the widow at Zarephath. Elisha rose the son of the Shunammite from the dead. Both had recently died, sort of hours beforehand. Jesus had raised Jairus' daughter, who had just died. Jesus had also raised the son of the widow of Nain, who was in his coffin being taken to be buried, who had recently died. So Jesus has already done something very unusual. He has raised 2 people from the dead. So far, no prophet has been able to raise more than 1 person from the dead. And it's centuries before. So long ago that people may have been thinking to themselves, "I wonder whether it's made up." Then Jesus comes, he raises 2 people. And people must have been astounded. This isn't just a prophet from old. This is someone special. But we then come to Lazarus. And as I say, he is 4 days dead. The Jews had a tradition, a belief, that the spirit of a dead person stayed with the body, or near the body, for up to three days. Indeed, in the previous raising of the dead, in at least one of them, there's the reference to the spirit returning to the body. But even if you accepted that 3 days, the 4 days of Lazarus was something exceptional. The spirit would have departed, according to the tradition. As I say, it's not biblical. And so raising him from the dead was something quite astounding. and is in front of all these people who had come to mourn him, to support the family. And Lazarus walks out of the tomb, still wrapped in the bandages. In my mind, I have to confess, I can't get rid of the 1940s, the mummy film. But of course, he wasn't mummified, he was just wrapped in cloths. But he walked out of the tomb. What a miracle. And of course, all the Jews go back to Jerusalem and start talking about it. Hey, that Jesus, he hasn't just raised the dead again. He has raised someone whose body was rotting in the tomb. He must be from God. And you had this excitement building. The story got around. And the story, of course, comes to the Jewish leaders. They have their Sanhedrin, they call this meeting, and discuss what to do about it. They are concerned because they are worried that the Romans, if too many people start turning to Jesus, are going to come in and take away both our place and our nation. The place might have referred to the temple. The place might have referred to the nation. But they were clearly fearful of the Romans, fearful of how they would react. Particularly bearing in mind that this was all prophesied, that the raising of the dead was part of the prophecy and a sign of the Messiah, the long-promised Messiah. They were concerned. And did you notice how Caiaphas, the high priest, God's chosen intermediary, if I can use that phrase, he is the one who speaks up, and does he really know what he's saying? You do not realise that it's better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish. He is in a way prophesying that Jesus is going to die and the whole nation will be saved. In fact, as of course we know, it's going to be much more than that. As it says in verses 51 and 52, it's not only that nation, but the scattered children of God, all mankind, to bring them together and make them one. The full import of that, I'm sure the Jews did not fully understand, or even the disciples didn't understand at the time. So much of what they realised was after Jesus had died on the cross at Calvary and be raised from the dead. But this creates a problem for Jesus. Because of this plot, because of all the concern about it, he decides to keep a low profile, as I put it. He flees in a way, withdrew to a region near the desert, to Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. He has to do this because the time is not yet right. God's plan is that Jesus would die as the perfect Passover lamb, as the perfect sacrifice, during the Feast of Passover. And so he withdraws, he disappears, and he and his disciples are there. But time marches on, and the Passover looms. It's just a short while away, and many Jews from all over the country go to Jerusalem for the cleansing period before the Passover. I've read various statistics over how the population of Jerusalem grew, how they grew so much at this time of year. We experienced that on the Isle of Wight in 1969, I can remember it, when the big pop festival at Afton Farm at Freshwater took place, and the population of the Isle of Wight, it was said, more than trebled. All because of the people who came to see the pop festival. But this was a regular occurrence in Jerusalem. Accommodation would be scarce. It was crowded. There were crowds and crowds of people, and they've all heard, it seems, about Lazarus. And they've all heard about Jesus. And we get this lovely detail that they stood in the temple area asking one another, what do you think? Isn't he coming to the feast at all? Where is he? They expected him to be in the temple. The chief priests and the Pharisees had also expected that. And as you see, they gave a diktat out that anyone who found out where Jesus was should report it so that they might arrest him. It would seem as if that didn't happen. What I mean is people didn't report where Jesus was. Because we know about this meal at Bethany. 6 days before the Passover. You know, the clock is counting down. Jesus' time of fulfillment, if I can call it that, is coming. And he goes to a house given in where a meal is given, a dinner is given, in Jesus' honour. Martha served. Do you remember the story back in Luke where Martha was worrying in the kitchen, if I can use that phrase, while Mary was at the feet of Jesus? And we're told that Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. A lovely picture. I infer from that heavily that Lazarus was eating. This wasn't a ghost. This was the body alive again, eating at the meal. And we get this small image at the meal of Bethany. A small detail, which is so important. 3 feet of Mary. Was she that short? Well, actually, technically, it was 6 feet of Mary. Was she that tall? No, what I'm referring to is that the first time we come across Mary, as I referred to earlier, she was sat at the feet of Jesus, learning, listening to him. That in itself is worth a sermon, because at this time, women weren't considered worth educating. The Romans, 60 years before, had an unfortunate experience. A woman had nearly destroyed Rome. It's the story of Julius Caesar and Cleopatra, only 60 years before. 60 years to some, I could say to some of you, might sound like a long time. It isn't. Yesterday, I went somewhere where I had not been for 60 years. You see, 100 years ago this week, while digging foundations for some garages, a Roman villa was discovered in Newport. That Roman villa was excavated. Part of it was covered over with a building, but some of the walls were left out in the open. And 70 years ago, my family and I, as a baby, moved to Newport. We lived in Clarence Road, which meant that as I grew up as a teenager, I explored the area around me. I used to play in what we called the Spinney. That was the River Medina, which had a nice slow path through a copse, and there were trout in it, and I can remember poaching a trout with my uncle. I used to play in the chalk pit, which is now a site of special scientific interest, and I used to play in the area, in the garden, or the ruins, of Newport Villa. I never went inside the building, but I can remember playing amongst the Roman walls. And as I say, yesterday, to commemorate the centenary, they actually had it open to the public for just £1. And I mean that I thought, yes, £1 is worth paying to go in. So I went in for the first time, 60 years after I was last there. And that's how recent it had been that Rome had had this shock of nearly being torn apart by a woman. And so Mary being taught at the feet of Jesus was remarkable. The second time we read about Mary is during the previous story about Lazarus being raised from the dead. We read that Mary runs out and falls at the feet of Jesus, saying, "If only you had been here." So that's the second time she's been at the feet of Jesus. And now, whilst Jesus was reclining at the table and eating, she comes, and again, she's at his feet. It's a position of absolute humility. You'll be aware that the rich people had servants to take off their sandals. It was a very, very lowly task. And a decent woman wouldn't unbraid her hair in public. And what we read is that Mary, with her hair, wiped the perfume into Jesus' feet. What an act of homage we have here. She is anointing not his head, which would have been expected, but his feet, and wiping it with her hair. She is so grateful that she's got her brother back. She acknowledges, as her older sister had earlier, that Jesus is clearly from God, that she's not worthy to be in his presence, and yet she's allowed to be there. And we get this wonderful image. And as it's been said many times before, when Jesus hung on the cross at Calvary, that perfume would still have been on his feet. The smell would have been there. Which is why Jesus, in chiding Judas, says, "She saved this perfume for the day of my burial." He knows what's going to happen. As an aside, as the former treasurer of this church, I always felt slightly misdone by the fact that the only reference to a treasurer of a group of Christians is this one here, Judas, the purse keeper, who was stealing from them. Well, you're very fortunate in having Helen as your treasurer, because there are churches around the island where treasurers have stolen money. I used to go to a church when I was a teenager, or early 20s, and it was the only church that I know of that used to take a double collection. It would often be said, "The speaker's done so well, we're going to pass the plate around again." It was only later that they discovered, after he died, that the treasurer had been stealing from them. And when he died, his widow came to the church and said, "I couldn't tell you before because my husband forbade me from doing so, but he was stealing from you." And she did what she could to repay as much as she could. But I digress. As I say, it's very easy for me to get sidetracked with all of this. And you have the reaction of the Sanhedrin. They decide that Lazarus has to die too. Why? Because whilst he's alive, that's the proof of Jesus' power over death. That's the proof that Jesus is part of creation, because he had to recreate the rotting corpse of Lazarus. And if Lazarus is dead, then it would be easier to dismiss it as, "Oh, it's just a rumour." But when Lazarus is walking amongst them and answering questions and explaining things, and when the other many witnesses to that miracle are there, they've got a problem. This is clearly someone who's not just close to God, but was close to God in creation. They've got a huge problem on their hands. And we come now to Palm Sunday, the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. What a picture it paints. I'm sure we've all seen pictures have been painted over the years of the crowds welcoming Jesus, strewing their cloaks, before the donkey. Jesus coming in, of the palm leaves, the palm fronds being waved, being placed on the road before him. The Romans were very good at spectacle, particularly spectacle after victory. The Caesar, the leader, would lead the army through the city of Rome or through the city they'd conquered. The Caesar would be, or the captain of the army, would be often on a white horse, a very imposing figure at the head of the army. And in amongst the army, or behind the army, would be brought the prisoners who'd been captured, the star of which was often the king of the captured country. He'd be humiliated and mocked. It was to show power. But here we have Jesus, not on a great white stallion, but on a donkey, on a colt. And we're told in this scripture that it was prophesied, "Do not be afraid, O daughter of Zion. See, your king is coming, seated on a donkey's colt." I want to read to you from Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9, because of what it goes on to say. And I say, Zechariah 9, 9, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on the donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. I will take away the chariots from Ephraim and the war horses from Jerusalem, and the battle bow will be broken. He will proclaim peace to the nations. His rule will extend from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. As for you, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I will free your prisoners from the waterless pit." And it goes on. And this brings me to the term Hosanna. You might have the same note in my Bible, that what it means is save. And is an abbreviation or shorthand version of saying, "God save us." And the question that I pose, is what did the people mean when they were saying, "God save us"? They were still thinking of Jesus, the promised Messiah, as being the great salvation, not from sin, but from the Romans. This was an occupied country. And Jesus was clearly viewed, can I use the phrase, as a political figure or as a word figure? And that verse in Zechariah, or that passage in Zechariah, talking about chariots, war horses, the battle bow being broken, peace to the nations, freeing the prisoners, that would all have spoken to the Jews of an earthly victory, of God's promised Messiah rescuing them from Roman rule, which is why the Sanhedrin were so upset and worried about it. This was the revolution that would disrupt their peaceful existence under the Roman peace. This was the revolution they feared. This would be when Rome would really stamp down hard on them, they feared. But we know, of course, that Jesus wasn't coming as a war leader, wasn't coming to overthrow the Romans, but was coming, as the passage Zechariah refers to proclaim peace to the nations, to bring salvation, because of the blood of my covenant with you. I've taken things slightly out of order there. But to us Christians, we see this triumphal entry into Jerusalem so differently. Jesus knows he's going to the cross. Jesus knows his time on earth living a human life is almost over. The Jews expected him to perhaps sneak in under cover of darkness, to come in heavily cloaked or disguised. They expected him to sneak in that way. They were completely caught short by the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And they didn't know what to do. They couldn't arrest him as he came in. They would have had a revolution on their hands, all right. And the very revolution they were trying to avoid. So this is what the triumphal entry into Jerusalem is. Jesus is coming to the end of his time. He's coming to the end of his time as a human. And he's coming to bring salvation. Not in the way that people expected. Not in the way the Jews expected. But salvation from sin.